contemplating calling for, this is an article I'm reading,
mm-hmm.
but they're wanting to boycott the election.
Oh,
and
okay.
I think that statement yep. is very important one. So I was thinking, you know, maybe, you know, I just wanted to bring that up for people. You know, what do we do? How do we stop this war machine? And, you know, a boycott of something. If, you know,
okay.
clearly people...
We have to go. But, yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. So thank you, Robbie, for that observation about how we might deal with the election, an option to boycott it. Thank you so much all for listening to your community radio station. This has been More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. Take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and on today's show, we look at how institutions we might once have believed to be impartial and fair, higher education and the courts, are complicit in injustice and in the pockets of the rich. Let me remind you that KBOO continues to bring you the voices of those denouncing those complicities and fighting to redress those wrongs. And you can support your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station by going to kboo.fm/give or clicking on the red donate box on the website or mobile app. On today's Old Mole, we hear Jan Hocken in conversation with Maya Wind, author of Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, out now from Verso Press. The book challenges the widespread understanding of Israeli universities as bastions of democracy, a view that has persisted even as the Israeli occupation forces have destroyed every campus in Gaza. Wind shows how Israel's vaunted liberal institutions are also sites where colonial expertise is reproduced and where Palestinian critical scholarship, pedagogy, and student dissent are stifled. Then, on the old mole, we turn to considering the ways that the Supreme Court of the United States has gone from being seen as a bastion of democracy and a vaunted liberal institution to blatantly serving the interests of chambers of commerce and the right wing. Bill Resnick talks with Russell Feingold, former three-term senator from Wisconsin and now president of the American Constitution Society. They discuss some of the many outrageous recent decisions of the court and consider possibilities for reform. Only three of the current Supreme Court justices would have granted a stay of execution to Marcellus Williams, executed last week in Missouri, despite the lack of physical evidence tying him to the crime and despite the prosecutor's office admitting multiple errors in violation of his constitutional rights. Jan Hocken returns with Mike Snedeker for an episode of The Left and the Law to discuss the injustice of capital punishment in the U.S. In a day or two, you'll be able to find the audio of this show and its segments, along with links to more information, posted on our website at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can listen again, subscribe to the show, share segments with others, contact us, and join KBOO. We go now to Jan Hocken in conversation with Maya Wind.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Maya Wind about her new book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedoms. She is a president in Andrew Mellon's postdoctoral fellow at University of California, Riverside. Her scholarship focuses on how settler societies and global systems of militarism and policing are maintained. Maya Wind, welcome to KBOO in the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Your book has been described as a powerful expose of Israeli academia's ongoing and active complicity in Israel's settler colonial project. It's particularly timing as the Justice for Palestine movement over the past year revives the BDS campaign against Israel, including boycotts against Israeli academic institutions. So let's start by talking about the book and perhaps some background to how you took on this project as a Jewish Israeli citizen.
Certainly. So I really came to research and to write this book, precisely as you said, in response to the call first issued by Palestinian intellectuals, activists, civil society organizations back in 2004, so 20 years ago already, to boycott the Israeli university system on the basis of what they called at the time its complicity in Israel's system of oppression against Palestinians. So this call was issued two decades ago, and yet in the North American academic context, where I have been based now for some time as a scholar, the overwhelming consensus about Israeli universities remains very much in keeping with their self-narration, the narration of Israeli universities, Jewish Israeli scholars and administrators themselves, as well as their Zionist supporters here in North America. And that impression or that reputation is one of Israeli universities as being bastions of pluralism and democracy. And in fact, Israeli universities have been singled out to receive special treatment by their Western counterparts, special opportunities for joint research, funding, grants, study abroad programs, collaborations that are not available to Palestinian universities or more broadly to other university systems in the Middle East. So Israeli universities have really been standing apart for some time, despite the fact that Palestinians have painted a starkly different picture of the Israeli university system and have called, in fact, for us to help hold it to account for its violation of Palestinian rights. And so really that is how I came to research and to write this book. And you mentioned I am a Jewish Israeli citizen. I used my privileges and my access as a Jewish Israeli citizen to reach not only state and military archives that are highly securitized, but also to freely access many Hebrew language sources that are not available because of a linguistic barrier to the broad international and academic community, as well as to spend a lot of time on Israeli campuses themselves. So I spent many months not only accompanying Palestinian student organizers, but also interviewing Jewish, Israeli, and Palestinian scholars, attending protests and lectures and events on campuses to really understand and to take stock of what is the nature of the complicity of the Israeli university system with Israel's system of apartheid.
So your research spanned both direct observational field reports, interviewing and maybe ethnographic reports, as well as archival research. And apparently the Israelis have a long history of very detailed archival materials, some of which apparently expose some of their own history that flies in the face of their own righteous narrative about themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And although I should also say, you know, that a lot of this information about the true nature of the Israeli university system is actually broadly celebrated and openly documented within Israel. So there is a sort of doublespeak that is going on where internally Israeli universities as institutions, not only are they structurally and materially embedded in the infrastructure that sustains Israeli society as a settler society, that sustains the regime of apartheid and now the genocide in Gaza, but also they routinely express openly and advertise their support for state projects, including for the military and the security state. So internally, this is well known. But when they speak to international audiences, they often present themselves as somehow separate from the state rather than an extension, a direct extension of its violence.
Well, part of what I found so compelling about your book, and it's very scholarly, but also quite a gripping read, was the whole question of how these academic institutions were deeply implicated in the maintenance of the military and security apparatus of Israel. And you could say the same, make the same arguments, and scholars have, about universities in the United States or North America more broadly. How would you see that dynamic expressed differently in Israel than any society where the ruling class, particularly countries with a powerful military, rely on their academic institutions?
Certainly. I mean, you are absolutely right to point out that Israeli universities are built in the rich tradition of other university systems in other settler states, particularly those established under the aegis of the British Empire. So thinking here about the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa. These are all settler societies that were established in and through the elimination of and dispossession of indigenous peoples with the explicit aim to replace them with settlers. And in all of these other states, universities have also played an important role in this project. So universities across these nations were built on lands cleared through genocide of indigenous peoples, and they themselves served as pillars of continual dispossession of indigenous peoples, and often, you know, also with the spoils of the slave trade. So certainly Israeli universities are not exceptional in that way. However, I would say that there are some important differences that we must attend to if we are trying to make sense of the role of Israeli universities and also in response to the Palestinian call for boycott. And the first most important difference, I think, is precisely that the indigenous community most directly impacted by the violence of these universities, in the Israeli case, these are the Palestinians, have called for a boycott. So a boycott is not only a matter of principle, it is also a tactic. And it has been a tactic chosen by Palestinians who have very correctly identified the Israeli university system as having a direct role in their subjugation and now the genocide in Gaza as well, and in years of sustaining apartheid rule and an occupation that now the ICJ has officially declared what Palestinians have said and legal scholars have long said and we have all long known, officially declared it as an illegal and permanent military occupation.
And so, also in their July ruling, called on institutions around the world to boycott Israel. So it was also striking, the support of the boycott movement from this recent ICJ ruling.
Absolutely. And also, you know, apartheid is a legal designation that carries with it a tremendous weight. So too is the fact that Israel is now on trial for genocide. So these are egregious crimes against humanity. And not every university system in the world, even though all of our universities are implicated in systems of violence, is directly upholding a regime of apartheid or sustaining a genocide, an act of genocide. So that is something that we must attend to. And you are absolutely right to point out that the ICJ ruling actually has raised our obligations for all of us in the international community to engage differently with Israeli institutions, including universities. There's now a legal obligation that we are all bound by.
Yeah, there are findings that you report around access, and that's often the case where groups that are minoritized have less access, less quality and funding of schools. But there are also these dynamics that are manifest in the content of the programs and the content of scholarship itself, as well as access. Can you talk about those two areas of your findings, both access and programmatic content of scholarship?
Yeah, so there are, as you said, structural barriers of access to higher education for Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. Certainly, not only because of years of disinvestment in their schools, but also because the Israeli university system has made it very difficult for Palestinian students to physically access campus, to make use of the dorm rooms, which is a particular problem for Palestinian students, given that there's a pervasive problem of Jewish landlords not wanting to rent to Palestinian students. So housing is a big barrier. There's also linguistic and economic barriers, physical barriers. And we see this very clearly. And this has been well documented, not only by Palestinian scholars, by Palestinian civil society organizations, but even by the Israeli state itself, that there are still longstanding structural disparities between Palestinian and Jewish Israeli students in access to higher education, where Palestinians are being purposefully left behind. And that is also because Israel has long seen educated Palestinians and Palestinian sites of education and institutions of education as a threat to its rule. And so this is why it has waged this war on Palestinian education. The latest iteration of it was with Israel's intentional destruction of every single campus of every university in Gaza, what Karman Abursi has called scholasticide. So this is part of a broader project and a war on Palestinian education over all the territories that Israel rules, from the occupied Palestinian territory to within Israel proper. And then the other question that you raise, which is an important one, is about what happens to Palestinian students and scholars when they do access, those who do manage to get access to the Israeli university campus. And here, too, we see a categorically different set of conditions under which Palestinian and Jewish Israelis get to study and research and write and learn. Because, for example, the Nakba, the foundational event and structure from the Palestinian perspective, through which over two-thirds of the Palestinian population was dispossessed and ethnically cleansed from historic Palestine, and which created itself the conditions of possibility for citizenship, Israeli citizenship, for those Palestinians who survived the Nakba and remained within the territory that became Israel after 1948. The Nakba is an incredibly central structure and event that Palestinian scholars and students wish to engage with and to study. And in fact, they argue that you cannot understand Palestinian society and you cannot conduct meaningful research about Palestinian society absent an engagement with the Nakba. And what we have seen is that over decades, critical work on the Nakba has been broadly disallowed and restricted heavily and policed by Israeli university administrators, by Israeli faculty and staff, and also even by Israeli students who are trying in every way possible to repress their fellow students, Palestinian students, from commemorating the Nakba or doing political education about the Nakba on the campus. And so this is just one of many examples to illustrate the repression of not only Palestinians themselves, but the Palestinian identity, Palestinian politics on Israeli campuses.
Is this one area where there's a gap between the archival records, which I think the group of historians called the New Historians found quite an extensive record of massacres, of violence, massive violent displacement of Palestinians during that period and subsequent to the 1948-49 Nakba, whereas you're talking about kind of politicizing or bringing those archives into the lived experience of academia. Did you find that gap between the archival materials available and the kind of the currency of ideas in universities?
Well, it's an interesting point because the archives itself are highly censored, right? So in Israeli state archives, under 3% of the files have ever been available for public use. And in the Israeli Defense Forces and Defense Establishment Archive, under half of a percentage of files have ever been available for public use. And public use includes, of course, university researchers. So broadly, Israeli state archives are incredibly censored, and many historians of all political persuasions speak to the almost impossibility of conducting any meaningful research in Israeli archives, let alone critical research.
Because they can always invoke security issues.
Yes, there's a military censorship, so this is a state policy. But universities have mounted no opposition to this policy as institutions, and it's also important to note the new historians that you mentioned, these are Jewish Israeli scholars who conducted indeed very critical and important research in these very archives. They conducted a research that in fact corroborated what Palestinian scholars had been saying for decades prior. But Palestinian scholars had already conducted oral histories. They had conducted archival research in other archives. They had deconstructed the massacres that took place in the Nakba. So there was no shortage of research about the events of the 1948 war prior to the new historians going in. But what is striking about what the new historians did do is that they corroborated this Palestinian research using Israeli sources based in Israeli state archives, which is why the Nakba entered the Israeli Academy for the first time and why it was engaged suddenly by Israelis. And of course, the backlash was incredibly fierce, and all but one of these new historians ended up being driven out of the Israeli Academy. Most reside in the UK. So what we're seeing is that even that brief opening within the Israeli Academy that was conditioned by the fact that the people who were bringing this research were themselves Jewish Israelis was quickly closed in the wake of this, not only with the state reclassifying documents used by the new historians, but also by the fierce backlash that they faced, which signaled for researchers in generations to come that such research would categorically be disallowed and would cost one their academic career.
Now, I want to ask you also about another area of your findings that is quite different from the U.S., where I think around 5% of U.S. citizens have an immediate family member in the military, either as a reservist or active member, whereas in Israel, all people of a certain age, men and women, are expected to participate as reservists. So there's a very different relationship in Israel to the military versus the U.S. How is that part of your findings, the role of the military, given that Israel itself is a very militaristic society that carries military pride as central to ideas of citizenship?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, you know, again, thinking about structure, because PACBI, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, in their call to boycott the Israeli Academy, they make very clear that the reason for this boycott is that Israeli universities are structurally embedded in the system of oppression against Palestinians. And we see this, for example, in the ways that every university campus in Israel makes itself available and becomes, in a way, takes on the qualities of a military base and aids the Israeli military in training soldiers. So there are over 50 degree programs for active duty soldiers run through the university system in conjunction with the Israeli military and the Israeli Ministry of Defense, as well as the Israeli and multiple Israeli weapons corporations. And this program is expressly designed to offer the Israeli military a cadre of highly specialized and skilled soldiers amidst what is otherwise a draft of high school seniors. And so what we see, for example, at Hebrew University, the Department of Islamic and Middle East Studies is currently training soldiers, offering them courses in regional and linguistic expertise on the Middle East so that they can better serve the intelligence corps. And many of them go on to serve in Unit 8200, which is the largest and most central unit of the intelligence corps that is responsible not only for the mass surveillance of Palestinians, but also now some of these soldiers are in fact creating target banks for killing of Palestinians in Gaza.
So there are many disciplines and specialties involved in this kind of support of the Israeli military.
Right. So yeah, so one aspect of this entanglement is the training of actual, you know, direct training of soldiers, of police officers, security state personnel, all the apparatuses that sustain the regime of apartheid. But there are other forms of collaboration, including, as you say, knowledge production in service of state projects and particularly in service of the Israeli military government. So entire disciplines and fields in the Israeli Academy developed in and through collaborating with the state and with the military government in particular, producing expertise and knowledge that would aid Israel in permanently governing Palestinians with military rule.
Well, before we close, I wanted to ask you what it's like for you and what the response to your book has been in Israel. Do you have colleagues there who support your project and your work? I know the peace movement and the left in Israel is quite small, but there is still a left.
You know, the state of what could be construed of the Jewish-Israeli left, especially this last year, is pretty dire. And just to say, you know, one of the reasons that I became active in the BDS movement and responded to the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, sanctions, including the academic boycott, is precisely because the gap between what is construed as left politics in the Jewish-Israeli context and what actual liberation will require, if we listen to what Palestinians are telling us, that gap is unbridgeable. And so what we really see is that there is a broad refusal, an abject refusal, by the really almost entirety of Israeli society to engage with Palestinian politics and the core demands coming from Palestinian society, the core rights that they are demanding recognition of. And so this is one of the reasons that we really need international intervention. I think it is very clear to everyone now with this last year with the genocide that Israelis will absolutely not stop. They will attempt to finish the project that they have always set out to do, which is to ethnically cleanse the entirety of Palestine of Palestinians. And so this is why international intervention is absolutely urgent, not only to secure an immediate and permanent ceasefire and to stop the genocide in Gaza, but also to stop the ethnic cleansing across Palestine that is happening now in an intensified way under the Israeli government in the last year. So the international intervention could not be more urgent at this time, including engaging in all forms of boycott, divestment, and sanction, primarily for those of us based in the university system, and especially in the United States, the main enabler of the Israeli state and a full partner in this genocide. Those of us based in the U.S. university system in particular have an urgent obligation to heed the call for academic boycott.
And in California, there are some collective actions in resisting the crackdown on pro-Palestine scholars and activists on the campuses. So then we'd love to have you on the show again to talk more about your own work and perhaps what's happening in California. Can you say a bit in closing about anything that you see happening in the UC system in fighting this new round of restrictions?
Absolutely. I think the student uprising across campuses this last year with Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, and many other student allied student groups, the phenomenal organizing of the student uprisings and the student encampments are really leading the way. There are now also over 100 chapters of faculty and staff for Justice in Palestine chapters across the United States, and there were over 180 encampments at universities across the world. So what we're seeing is a broad and very courageous movement led by students that refuse to inherit the university as it is being passed down to them and refuse to remain silent about the genocide in Gaza and about the ways that their own universities are directly entangled and complicit in Palestinian unfreedom. And so we're going to see much more of that, much more organizing by students, by faculty. And I hope that everyone listening here who hasn't already joined the movement.
Well, thank you so much, Maya Nguyen, for being with us today, talking about your important and agonizingly relevant new book, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedoms. Where can people find your book?
Yeah, so the book is available at multiple bookstores, including directly at the Verso website.
Terrific. I encourage people to read the book, and we'll continue to follow your scholarship. And thank you for being with us today on the Olmo Variety Hour.
Thank you for having me. Our fear cannot explain the words that they
take my problem to the United Nations.
That was some of PJ Harvey's song, The Words That Maketh Murder. And before that, Jan Hocken talking with Maya Wind, author of Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Later on today's show, Jan will be back with her Left and the Law partner, Mike Snedeker, for a discussion of capital punishment and the case of Marcellus Williams, who did not get a stay of execution from the Supreme Court, despite the apparent constitutional violations in his case. We turn now to Bill Resnick talking with Russell Feingold, president of the American Constitution Society, about some other recent bad decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Hi, Russell Feingold. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be on. Appreciate the invitation.
Russ Feingold served 3 years as a U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He co-sponsored the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, the McCain-Feingold Act, the only major piece of climate finance reform legislation passed into law in quite a long time. It was, of course, found unconstitutional in 2010, one of the first right-wing decisions of today's conservative Supreme Court. The case is known as Citizens United. As a senator, he was alone in voting against the USA Patriot Act. He opposed the Iraq War. He was the Senate's leading opponent of the death penalty. For the last 10 years, he's taught constitutional law and foreign policy as a visiting professor at a variety of law schools and universities. Today, he also serves as president of the American Constitution Society, an organization of law school professors, law students, and others. It's a nationwide network, includes nearly 200 student and lawyer chapters, and progressive lawyers, students, judges, scholars, elected officials, and advocates are members. Finally, he also writes 2 books and appears in lots of media. Today, we'll be discussing the current Supreme Court, the vast damage it's done, and what can be done about it. Just in the last several months, they've declared the President of the United States absolutely immune from criminal prosecution for official acts. The court also sees the responsibility and power to issue regulations like the Environmental Protection Agency standards for lead in playground soil. It's now subject to judicial adjudication and decision by the judges themselves, not the scientists. The court also ruled that would-be mass shooters can buy attachments to change their weapons into machine guns. White state legislatures can systematically remove all black people from their districts. And say about this gerrymandering, it's just politics. And to add a dose of cruelty, the court also ruled that insurrectionists who attack the Capitol and obstruct the work of Congress can be charged only with minor crimes. But homeless people sleeping on the streets, they can be sent to jail. And the justice has also rejected being bound by the ethics rules of federal government. They can still be paid handsomely for their fine decisions for our super wealthy. The list goes on. In 2012, gutting the Voting Rights Act. 2022, it overturned Roe v. Wade. And before that, they immunized police from personal liability. And then there was appointing George Bush president, stopping a full counting of the ballots. Not a very good precedent nowadays. Anyway, we can hardly examine all of these, but we can do some. So, Russ Feingold, tell us about the case Trump versus U.S., how the court came to it, what was the basis of their decision to immunize upcoming presidents from prosecution for crimes they commit.
Well, first of all, Bill, thank you so much. That's quite a parade of horribles you just read. It's one thing when you hear one of them, but when you hear them all together, it's just incredibly disturbing. And in fact, our organization, the American Constitution Society, was founded in reaction to one of the cases you mentioned, which, of course, was Bush v. Gore. All of a sudden, people woke up and realized after Bush was declared the winner in a very bogus and political decision, they realized that the court had become so politicized and partisan, you couldn't trust it in a way that we used to believe we could. And then you come to an era where, long after Watergate and the famous decision denying Nixon unanimously the idea of executive privilege, you end up with a court that actually gives an absurdly extreme version of presidential immunity. This wasn't something that had built up gradually over the years as a right-wing agenda. it seems to be something that grew out of reaction to Trump and support for Trump and his trying to protect him from all the obvious criminal conduct that he was involved in, both as president and after he was president. So obviously there would be some immunity. But the way the court talked about official acts was so broad that it could potentially immunize the president from almost anything. And that we won't know for many years. We might start knowing next year, but we won't know for many years just exactly how the court will apply this standard. It's really disturbing, and many very relaxed, calm people have described it as creating basically a monarch, the very thing that the founders didn't want.
Yeah, and I've read some of the stuff that they've published in supporting it. It seems that not only has the court immunized all of his acts, they make it clear that they want him to use it for ends that were formerly seen as illegitimate, like using the Justice Department for political ends. That was, I think, it's an unwritten law that the Justice Department was not the servant of the president. It was the servant of the people. And
that was the lesson learned from Watergate. You know, it's true that it wasn't clear, that distinction. But the lesson learned from Watergate by Gerald Ford, the president there, was that the Justice Department can't be just the lackey for the president. And so he appointed a very conservative guy, a conservative jurisprudent, a president of the University of Chicago, Edward Leavy. And everybody would have thought perhaps he would be very conservative, but he insisted on creating a Justice Department that was independent from the whims of the president. And that is a 50-year tradition that is being gutted. And of course, if certain things happen in the election, it could be gutted very soon. So it's a major step backward to the era of Watergate if that happens.
Russ Feingold, tell us about another atrocious decision, the reversal of the Chevron case, a power grab by the Supreme Court, taking on responsibilities that never succeed in satisfying, but putting joy in the hearts of polluters.
Yeah, it's very hard to beat the outrageousness of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs decision. But this Chevron decision is, in your words, really one of the fantasies of the right. When I was teaching law at four different law schools across the country, the very conservative students would always mention, hey, we got to get rid of this Chevron decision. And what, of course, it means is they don't want administrative agencies to be able to do things to protect us. They don't want them to be able to act on COVID. They don't want the EPA to be able to deal with clean water issues and climate change. And so what they want to do is hamstring these agencies by not allowing them to promulgate reasonable rules, and somehow wait for Congress to make impossibly detailed regulations that could never come out of Congress. I know I was there for 18 years. It's a way to try to basically bleed the federal government from its ability to protect Americans and somehow believe that state by state you can handle COVID or state by state you can handle environmental problems, which of course isn't true. You can't just do it that way. So this is possibly the worst decision. It's possibly the decision that has the greatest ramifications because it can affect every agency of the federal government, and it could seriously undermine our ability to protect ourselves.
In reversing the Chevron decision, Chief Justice Roberts reasoned that judicial deference to agency rulemaking under Chevron was incompatible with the court's fundamental duty to interpret the law. Well, this fundamental duty to interpret the law means that, and the practical impact is that the federal courts and then the circuit and Supreme Court, they would be making all of those decisions, not the scientists. And when a corporate polluter with deep pockets can't convince the scientists who have studied this thing that, in fact, they shouldn't be punished for some dangerous environmental practices.
That's exactly what they're doing.
They're putting it in the courts. And these guys, like the Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, there's very few scientists that can penetrate the fog that the companies can put up.
Yes, that's very well said. Let me say that, of course, that's the way they want it, too. They want to be able to just stop stuff by making it so impossible for the agencies to do it, because what they're really doing, as in the labor cases and many other cases, they're doing the bidding of the big companies and the billionaires. You can see it from who they hang out with on their private trips that they shouldn't be taking. They are the tool of the Chamber of Commerce and the very wealthy in this country. And that is one of the only consistent things that you can see, is they almost always side with the very well-to-do and big businesses. And what they really want is that these federal agencies can't do anything to them. And so they make it impossible to get, as you say, real expert help to promulgate rules through agencies. Because Congress itself, even if it wasn't corrupted, can't do it because it doesn't have the capacity to do it. You have to have an agency with people who can work with the experts, as you've said. Well, they don't want that. They just want to hand over the goodies to the big guys.
I'm talking to Russ Feingold, three-term senator, now the president of the American Constitution Society. So far, we've discussed the empowerment of the president to commit crimes, including murder of his critics, and empowerment of the Supreme Court over all federal regulation, and the rest of the federal courts to ignore what the Congress and scientists and the federal regulatory agencies have done, and in fact, write their own laws and regulations. Next, we'll discuss the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board. Because the billionaires, Amazon, Tesla, and Trader Joe's, are miffed that the board forced them to rehire workers they had fired for union organizing. The companies have brought suit claiming that the NLRB has amassed powers that defy the Constitution. I'm afraid at best, or maybe worst, the National Labor Relations Act and the board will survive, but toothless and impotent. What's your sense of how this came about and the possibilities of, at least in liberal administrations, enforcing labor laws?
Yeah, this is, again, part of the longtime fantasy. These big, powerful companies have never gotten over the idea that there's a legitimate labor movement in this country. And many of the decisions of the Supreme Court are incredibly hostile to labor and labor organizing directly, but also what they do is indirectly. They want to undermine the NLRB, which is crucial for working people to vindicate their rights. For years, they were trying to just not fill the seats on the NLRB when President Obama was president, as a way to try to gut it by not even filling it. But now, as you suggest, they're going after it directly and trying to delegitimize what it does. This turns back the clock almost 100 years. And it's the same thing that it was Citizens United. They didn't overturn McCain-Feingold. That's still the law. What they overturned was the 1907 Tillman Act, which prohibited corporations from directly giving money to campaigns. So this is part of a broader agenda to stop anything that gets in the way of a monopolistic control of our economy and our political system by corporations. So this is very disturbing. And although a lot of the attention, as it should, goes to things like the Dobbs decision and the decisions regulating the guns and immunity, some of the greatest damage may occur in the context of the Chevron decision and, as you say, the attack on the NLRB.
So with all of that, the question arises, what can be done to replace the Supreme Court with a group of honest jurists?
That's what we have to do.
And what's the American Constitution Society doing?
We're one of the two or three leading organizations in the country advocating what we call judicial reform. And what this is basically saying, look, the court has become politicized and biased and is really just doing political bidding and acting like a legislature. And we have to make changes to the court. And this is gaining ground. In fact, President Biden has now finally endorsed the idea of some kinds of judicial reform. We support three kinds of judicial reform. First, we believe you should add seats to the Supreme Court. That is completely legitimate. The court has been different sizes over the years, and they stole the Supreme Court. They stole the Scalia seat, and they stole the Ginsburg seat by cheating with the Senate rules. And at least those two seats should be balanced by adding seats to the Supreme Court, which can be done by legislation. The second thing, which Biden did endorse, is term limits, saying that members of the Supreme Court should only be able to serve as justices of the Supreme Court for 18 years. They can serve on lower courts beyond that. But that is something that I believe can be done by legislation. Some people think it has to be done by constitutional amendment. But in any event, it's obviously become absurd and a form of game playing to have these lifetime terms where you have somebody as sick as Justice Ginsburg trying to just hang on because of the way this system works, and it was not the way the thing should be. The third thing is we need ethics rules. These guys, they're the only judges in the country that don't have rules like this. The lower courts have to follow strict rules about gifts and trips and the like and revealing what they do. And all they do is have very mild rules with no enforcement. And it's a form of self-policing, and they don't self-police. So you have these abuses like these incredible trips being taken by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. So we believe that Congress can and should impose regulations, ethics rules. It's long overdue. Congress has rules like that for itself. The White House has rules like that for itself. The lower courts have rules like that for themselves. The Supreme Court should have it as well. So those are all things that can be done. And depending on the outcome of the presidential election, I suspect there could be real action on this next year.
Well, what if the court just declares that's unconstitutional, maybe on the doctrine of separate spheres, and they can make a better case for that than they can for gun control, for their most of the atrocious decisions over these last years have less basis than declaring it unconstitutional to pack the court. Then you run right into a constitutional crisis.
That's right.
They're basically demanding that they not be changed in any way.
That can't be tolerated. And in fact, I would say that the term limits piece, they might have an argument, but they have no argument, constitutional argument whatsoever, to say you can't add judges to the court. It's been done many times. It's explicit in the Constitution that the Congress shall set the size of the court. And there would be no basis for that. If they did it, it would require a constitutional amendment to overturn it. And that they could be done. The court can't declare a constitutional amendment unconstitutional. But I think they could not get away with it. They can't get away with it. So that's why I actually think the first thing they should try to do is add seats. I also think they should do term limits, but yeah, that would probably be challenged, and it would be an interesting case, and probably they would not do the right thing on that. But these are things we can do, and if nothing else, it puts pressure on them, like happened when Franklin Roosevelt tried to add seats to the court. He didn't succeed, but the court got nervous enough about what it was up to, you know, destroying workers' rights in this country and other than human rights, that they stopped doing some of it, and that was called the stitch in time that saved nine. So just a mere president doing this.
Yeah, just the attack may change their positions quite a
bit.
That's right. And I think we have to sign off, Russ.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Bill. It was a pleasure to be on your show. And
good talking to you, Russ.
All right, talk to you later.
So long. It's been a blow because they got the TV. We got the truth. They own the judges and we got the proof. We got hella people. They got helicopters. They got the bombs and we got the
That was some of The Guillotine by The Coup. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Russell Feingold of the American Constitution Society, discussing how the kleptocrats have bought the Supreme Court and what reforms are possible. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Finally today, we hear from Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken, The Left and the Law, about the case of Marcellus Williams, the legal fetish for finality, and the frequency with which the U.S. executes innocent people.
Protesters showed up en masse across the state of Missouri last week in an effort to pressure the governor to halt the execution of Marcellus Williams, a black man on death row. Prosecutors in St. Louis, where Williams was convicted, had asked courts to overturn his conviction, but the state's attorney general, Andrew Bailey, opposed those efforts. Governor Mike Parson turned down requests to stop the execution, and the Supreme Court refused to intervene on the day of the execution with the three liberal judges wanting to grant Williams a stay. Well, Mike, let's talk about this tragic case of the killing of Marcellus Williams and how this could be carried out when even the prosecution in the case came to believe that he was innocent. You're an appellate lawyer. Your work is death penalty appeals. What happened here?
Well, you should add the fact that the victim's family also opposed it, as did the jurors. The reason it happened is because of the fetish of finality. People who believe in the death penalty and who address the issue, who supported the execution, talked about the fact that this had already been resolved. They believe that continuing to poke around and re-examine cases is an unending process, that we need to put it all to a halt. It's a way of protecting bad government decisions, the principle of finality. It's the only thing that the governor talked about in denying clemency. It's the only thing that the attorney general talked about, is the fact that this case has already been considered by such a number of people. And the burden becomes really enormous. Like what happened in this case was that Williams' supporters, and there were many, because there was reams of physical evidence at the crime scene. A young female reporter was stabbed 40 times or so. There were bloody shoe prints. There was the murder weapon actually left there. None of the physical evidence was ever linked to Marcellus Williams. He was convicted on the basis of what might have been some of the victim's possessions in his car. And the statements made by an ex-girlfriend and by a jailhouse snitch, that was the evidence against him. He had long hoped that a DNA testing of the murder weapon would exonerate him. And he finally achieved a DNA test. What the DNA test found were fingerprints of prosecutors and their investigators. They had handled the knife extensively, claiming decades later not to know that this would have any effect on anything that counted. So it was not as clean and clear as the Central Park Five, where you had not only evidence of coerced confessions, but you had DNA pointing to a specific person who, that specific person confessing to having committed the crime. But this was murkier. But with the death penalty, of course, there is no taking it back. Once you execute people, it's not going to matter now. But what emerges in the future, Marcellus Williams is dead. He was an impressive people. What happens with people on death row is when they spend decades there, they change. Some of them continue to get more bitter and angry and weak, and others actually are steeled by that fire and they become exceptional people. And Williams had become an exceptional person. He was a Muslim. He had become a Muslim leader. He wrote poems. He talked to people and carried himself in such a way that he recognized that he had led an unlawful life in the past, but he had changed. He really had. And so he impressed a lot of people.
And he also stayed with his innocence in this case.
Absolutely. And there was nothing that you would regard or I would regard as solid evidence pointing to him as the perpetrator.
How much of an outlier was this case? Can you put it in some broader context?
You know, even people like me, who is a professional skeptic, you know, I'm supposed to doubt everything about any case that I take on, have been shocked by how often they get it wrong according to DNA tests. You know, it's probably fair to say that 1 out of 10 cases is bad, that they got the wrong person. That seems like that's pretty good, certainly for government work, 9 out of 10.
So how many people are on death row in this country now?
There's about 2,200 people on death row. So looking at that 1 out of 10, that means there are 200 innocent people sentenced to death in this country. And that's probably a good guess. The politics is remarkable here in that it's one of the very clearest distinctions, along with abortion, between the political parties. You know, we know that the Republicans and the Democrats are like one unified blob of power that vote together on many critical issues like size of the defense budget, Israel. There's a host of issues where they're not different at all, but they're sharply different on the death penalty. A vivid example of that is that Pamela Harris's one exhibition of spine as a politician in California was when she was a newly elected district attorney in San Francisco, and there is the cop killing happened, and she refused to ask for the death penalty for the perpetrator of that crime.
And those are particularly charged cases.
Yeah, exactly. The cop killing cases are, it's just unheard of not to seek capital punishment in such a case. She didn't. And she took a lot of heat, but she weathered that, and then it passed. And the Republicans are notorious for having executed something like 13 people in a matter of months during the last few months of the Trump administration, when William Barr asked for and got permission to execute all these people whose cases had been pending, who were on federal death row. Many of them had solid claims of either being having IQs of under 70 or either substantial claims of errors in jury selection, and one or two of them had good innocent claims that had not been really verified. They were all executed.
Is this another example of how the right wing, including those in power in the Republican Party, depart quite a bit from popular views or the views of everyday citizens, where support for the death penalty has dropped substantially, as I understand it, in recent decades?
Well, it varies. It's evolving more and more into a blue state, red state split. In Oregon now, we have a death penalty, but it's reserved for people who deliberately kill cops or a child under the age of 13 or a person who is a terrorist who kills two or more people, and there have not been any capital trials since the 2019 when the law changed. In California is a mini U.S. where there have been decreasing use of the death penalty, and recently in two big counties on the coast, Santa Clara County and Alameda County, they've essentially gotten rid of everybody who was convicted and sentenced to death there. 18 people in Santa Clara County are having their sentences dropped to a perpetual life in prison. And in Alameda County, some 30 people are going to have their sentence reduced because of a scandal about jury selection, where it became clear that the prosecutors had a systematic plan of eliminating Black people, particularly Black women and Jews, for being purportedly soft on death.
Just in closing, Mike, and talking about this sad case of the killing of Williams last week in Missouri, there are some excellent organizations that follow developments around the death penalty. The Innocence Project, which has a chapter here in Oregon, has been really important in advancing this issue of doubt, you're saying, has been suppressed. What would you suggest beyond following the Innocence Project?
Well, there is a great organization, the Death Penalty Information Project. DPIC.org will give you all the info you want about the racial breakdown, numbers, changes. But I want to bring everyone's attention to the upcoming scheduled execution of Robbie Robertson in Texas on October 17th. It's the first capital case I know of a shaken baby syndrome. It's a crime that never even happened. And yet he's going to not only have lost his daughter, but he's going to be killed because this young infant died. So there are massive numbers of experts, of popular organizations appealing for him, but it's Texas. So the principle of finality is, I think, going to prevail there. And this U.S. Supreme Court will do nothing to get in the way.
Yeah. Well, on that really sad note, that is also enraging and hopefully will involve mobilizing in Texas in protest. Thanks, Mike, for joining me today on The Left in the Law to talk about capital punishment and the killing of Marcellus Williams last week.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now.
That was a little of This Is America by Childish Gambino, and before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, discussing capital punishment. I'm Fran Michel, and you've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. In a day or so, you'll be able to find slightly longer versions of all of today's segments by visiting the segment pages online at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can also support the show and the station by clicking on the red donate tab. Thanks so much to those of you already KBOO members for supporting Portland's volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. And thanks to all the staff and volunteers who keep KBOO, KBOO. Thanks to my fellow moles and today's guests. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Maya Wind for their conversation about how Israeli universities deny Palestinian freedom. Thanks to Jan and her Left and the Law partner, Mike Snedeker, for their discussion of capital punishment and the court system's finality fetish. Thanks to founding mole Bill Resnick and his guest, Russell Feingold, for their conversation about some of the many terrible decisions from the current Supreme Court and the possibilities for reform. Thanks to Joe Clement for performing our theme song. Thanks to John Nielsen for editing. And thanks to Patricia Kullberg for mole coordination. The Old Mole will be back next Monday. Stay tuned now for Locus Focus. We'll go out with a little more of PJ Harvey's The Words That Maketh Murder.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO.